And we're live with our 322nd episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Excited to be here. Have a lot to talk about. There's been a lot of articles that we want to discuss. The speed of all things news cycle nowadays is so much that there is a plethora of data and things that we can talk about. Before we get into it, though, I did want to reiterate the training opportunities that are coming up for Ken and I. Specifically during Hacker Summer Camp, we've got at Black Hat, AI enhanced secure code review, where we're going to go through the full secure code review process, as well as how to harness LLMs to implement secure code review. So if you ever want to build your own, you know, Mythos or whatever, right? Like, which I get questions about from everyone nowadays, you can do that. You don't have to use Claude, right? Let's be honest, you don't have to use Anthropic to do the same thing. So you can learn how to do it there, or if you just want the very specific security tasks, we're teaching that at DEF CON, the two-day course there, which will do a dive into manipulating and harnessing LLMs. Now that LLM harnesses are a thing, we're a little cutting edge there, because we've always been, that's what we've been trying to do for years, is harness LLMs to do our daily work and to help speed up our process. And even today, right? Like I think about how I'm using LLMs and doing some research on, you know, very specific client frameworks and interactions and stateful like web interactions with WebSockets, and how useful it is to be able to put together a workflow quickly that uses LLMs to break down and parse and understand what an application is actually doing. How those frameworks actually implement state changing operations, yada, yada, yada. There's not a better way to do that currently, right? Like outside of, you know, harnessing those LLMs to actually build those pipelines out. It's something that would have taken 2 to 3, if not 4 days in the past, but nowadays I can do it within, you know, 20 minutes. I've got a deep understanding or a better understanding of how these applications interact. So come take those trainings. You can find, I'll post the links really quick again. I haven't updated the training site, but it's coming. I'll get to it this afternoon. So if you're wondering where those trainings are, go to blackhat.com or training.defcon.org. Those are the two places that you can currently sign up. And they are both in early registration, so they're a little bit less expensive than they will become. Outside of that, I'm going to be at B-Sides Vancouver this weekend. So I'll be up in British Columbia for a couple of days, helping with a workshop on, you know, it's a little bit different, but it's actually, you know, building an SDLC in the age of AI. Cameron White, that works with us at Redpoint, is actually running the workshop, but I'll be helping out there. And then also have a talk on user enumeration that I'm doing with Justin Larson. That's on Monday. This is, you know, one of those Crocs and Socks vulnerabilities that's near and dear to my heart. I know that the risk level kind of depends on the target itself or the threat model that goes along with it, but it's a really interesting use case of both LLMs and a whole bunch of things. So if you're going to be at B-Sides Vancouver, let me know. Love to go out, talk with people, and yeah, talk all the Crocs and Socks. Ken, what does your upcoming schedule look like?
I don't have any travel, which is amazing, until the summer. August. So right now I don't have, I'm sure things will get put into the schedule, but right now pretty open. So one thing that was funny is that on last week's episode, you had mentioned going to B-Sides, and then I had mentioned that, Vancouver, and then I had mentioned that Justin Collins was going to the one that was held yesterday in Calgary. funny enough, he happened to be driving to the B-Sites Calgary, and he was like listening to our podcast, and he heard that. He like hit me up on Slack. Hopefully he wasn't driving when he hit me on Slack, but like actually in the middle of driving. But anyways, yeah, he is funny, small world, kind of full circle thing. So
yeah.
But no, I don't have any travel. I'm really stoked about that.
Yeah. Oh no, that's great, right? Like it's good to get a break, right? You've been traveling nonstop, and that's what it feels like, at least. The other thing that actually popped out of that last episode that you and we didn't highlight on the podcast, but was in Slack. Again, if you're not in Slack, you should be. We've got a couple of people reach out and have sent links out. Was kind of a book club almost, right? Like in general, after we started talking through the basics of AppSec, right? Like the articles and recommendations that we would have. I know I initially did a blog post about this on Absolute AppSec, right? And it's been a while, right? Let's see. I was going to link to it, right? Or maybe it's, man, where did that actually go?
maybe it's not there anymore. In general, I'm trying to find it, but it was, I think, Cameron brought this up. A reading.
Yeah, I was just like, I used to have a post up about like the basics of AppSec, and I think it got moved in one of the. Anyway, doesn't matter. As I'm looking back up through, right, just add Claude, one of the things I mentioned the Ware report all the time, right, like from the late 60s, early 70s on the, you know, the basics of computer securing network connected systems, I think is what it's actually called, right? That's a good place to start on like the theory, right? Art of Computer Programming. It was funny that to listen to to read what listeners had to say about important books, right? Because it feels like we always go back to, yeah, there's the security basics, but we always go back to programming basics as well. I know the Art of Computer Programming, C++, the OG software programming books are really quite good on access control, on logging, on all of these things that we kind of take for granted. And, you know, we will have in newer books that are out there, but we come at it from a very kind of refined or narrow mindset, right, of security only instead of programming across the board. And I was having this discussion with a friend yesterday, right? Like one of my son's friends was over for the holiday, and we were talking. Of course, he asked me about Mythos because he's a, you know, college student or whatever it is. And he's like, oh, has that changed computer security? So we kind of got into it. And what came up actually was a discussion on availability, right? And how you and I, and even the industry as a whole, we're seeing a degradation in availability because of the amount of code that's being generated, and how the industry in general has seemed to accept that we don't need to have 5 nines anymore. We only need 2 nines, right? That's enough. And there are still those segments of the market that demand high availability that are never going to accept 2 nines, or heaven forbid, like 1 9, right? As an availability marker. Finance, healthcare, like there's just segments of the market that cannot do their job if they don't have available systems. So even though it might be fine for developers or for some startups to have a system or an API that goes down, what happens when Amazon is no longer 5 nines or 6 nines, right? AWS in general, there are real world consequences and financial penalties that are come into play if we actually allow that to happen. Anyway, I'm kind of getting off topic there, Ken. But, you know, if you have recommendations for books, drop them in there. We may start a book channel, or we may even just throw out a blog post that has a number of these different books that are in there, because they are so crucial to our understanding of how to secure systems. And I feel like we need to step back a little bit from actually implementing code to the overarching, like, Crocs and socks of what security actually is. So,
yeah, I was actually just trying to read an article to get some perspective on but I mean, I'll say this is like, this article or this post from on Hacker News is from 4 years, 5 years ago, actually. Yeah. Yeah. 5 years ago, complaining, about a lack of Five Nines. So it may, and I see some more things about the myth of Five Nines, and there's some articles on like questioning whether that's even a real, there's value there. I think, you know, what you're really saying is that like there are certain services like, you know, like GitHub, where we all work on, and you can't just, it's problematic to just go, down constantly. And, I think you're trying to say that, you know, good programming practices still apply. I'm reaching, I think I'm reaching, but I'm trying to connect all this. We should use that to launch into some of the stuff that we talked about before the show with GitHub. Books are you talking about?
Yeah, he was asking, book written like, the book is written like assessment findings. Yeah. Sweet. So GitHub, right? Like, so we talk about like, you know, Crocs and socks, the basics, like the controls, like the understanding that we need. So there was a recent, and we'll start with the actual Megalodon breach, right? And then we can back into the NPM stuff that goes along with that. But it came to light this last week that there was something like 5,000 different repositories that were compromised in what they're calling the Megalodon breach. Which article do you want to start with there, Ken?
Yeah, I'm actually pulling it up right here.
Or do you want to start with the, where is it?
I got it up on screen.
Oh, sweet. Okay. Yep, Step Security, right? So there's GitHub Actions. They were poisoning various repositories, stealing secrets from those repositories using GitHub Actions. And I think our initial thought was, I know my initial thought was, oh, good, look, you know, somebody else has, you know, compromised some credentials or whatever it is, or they've found another hole in GitHub. And that's how a lot of these articles are written. They found a hole in GitHub to actually steal these credentials or submit PRs that execute GitHub Actions to actually steal those credentials. But that's not necessarily the case in the research that you did, correct?
Yeah, well, or not the research I did, but the research that I'll pull up here from Info Stealers, from Hudson Rock, sorry. But to just, cover that, like you said, because Seth and I were talking before the show. So let's talk about the actual vulnerability, or except not the vulnerability, the attack. And then the questions that Seth and I had and some of the answers we were able to dig up. So, you know, another one of these situations where, and actually I should say like, okay, what is the actual attack? And then let's talk about some of the weaknesses that allow this attack to happen. So it seems like in this particular scenario, someone was able to get credentials, which will be a question mark that we answer in a little bit. But when we say credentials, we mean like a GitHub user's credentials. Okay. And then they're able to take that and push and modify workflow files. So GitHub action files, which are just YAML files. And they basically have like a base64 string. So non-obvious, and then once decoded, it basically runs harvest credential. It harvests credentials. That's what it runs some software to do that. Now, when it does that, it steals tokens, it steals SSH creds, it steals whatever else it can get, right? So you already have a compromised GitHub account. You make a change to a workflow file. When that action runs in the CI/CD pipeline, whatever basically credentials it has access to will be stolen and exfiltrated somewhere. Okay. So that's the attack, but there's a few things to point out. So the first thing that's pointed out, and I think it may be in this article, they talk about this, and it is very true. And by the way, this is called I didn't know this before today, by the way, direct poisoned pipeline execution. Now I'm sure Cameron, friend of the show, Cameron Walters, Cameron Walters, sorry. He talks about this kind of stuff. So I'm sure he's very, very intimately familiar with, but direct poison pipeline execution, that's what this is labeled as. And the big issue is that if there was a pull request flow right with branch protection, meaning you can't just push directly to a default branch, a pull request is required and, you know, maybe one or two approvers to actually merge in the PR, then this significantly reduces this attack from being viable. So just want to point out that there is still a world in which PR flows do help out. And this is one of those moments. But then there's the question of, and this is where we're going to switch to a different screen. This is where Seth and I started asking questions like, okay, but how did they get those GitHub? Like, did they get GitHub? Did they basically compromise one GitHub user, use the modified workflow in the actions pipeline to then still additional credentials? It didn't really make necessarily any sense, but this is where we started doing a little homework. And Hudson Rock had put out this, essentially they have some info stealer intelligence database where they track sort of things like this, right? What they noticed were that the list of the compromised GitHub usernames match what's inside of, or match their database from stolen credentials using info stealers malware. But what they pointed out, and by the way, remember I had mentioned Base64, there's some of your Base64 encoded payload hidden inside the YAML workflow files. What they had mentioned was that Team PCP basically had open sourced their Shai-Hulud framework. So it really, they use the word democratization of malware, I think that, or the phrase, I think that's true. I think that's fairly true. They made it much easier to pull off these types of attacks. So putting it all together, their assertion here on this article is that, you know, effectively they, I tried to use this, by the way, Cavalier GPT, couldn't get it to work, but apparently like you can search for usernames to see if they're in the list of their compromised database or whatever. You can do 100 usernames, it says. I can't even get one, so if you can get it to work, great, awesome. In any case, basically what we're trying to say is they believe that through Shai-Hulud and Team PCP open sourcing the framework they used for Shai-Hulud, that they made it much easier and then combine it with stolen credentials. And then here you go, you have 5,000 something odd commits across 5,000 something odd repos, all with stolen credentials, leading to further exploitation as those action workflow files run and then, credentials get harvested. Does that sound mildly coherent, Seth?
Yeah. And that was kind of the initial like misunderstanding that we had is how they got the credentials to actually run the attack and submit those PRs to run the GitHub actions. So it's definitely it's all scripted up, right? Like this is them using, I think you mentioned the Shai-Hulud framework that was accidentally or intentionally open sourced, whatever you want to call it, to identify more and pull more credentials, but somebody else went and pulled from their current database of leaked credentials and stolen credentials from developer desktops in order to run an additional campaign to, you know, probably install additional malware and start to do ransomware and other things, right? Yeah, I mean, we've always said that the deep web or the marketplaces that exist on the deep web sell credentials, stolen credentials as it is. So once it's exposed, it's exposed. If you're not rotating and you don't realize that, it's a bad thing. But in addition to that, they've always had software as a service underneath the hood there that actually does this sort of activity. So the democratization of Shai-Hulud across all of these players should not be a surprise. That was what was going to happen anyway. They're always looking for additional avenues to generate revenue, just like any company. So the fact that it actually has happened at this point should not be surprising to anybody in that space. But good write-up by Hudson Rock to actually identify that, what the root cause was, because a lot of the articles were a little sensationalized that it was GitHub somehow exposing those credentials, which was not the case.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anything else you want to talk about on that? I feel like these sorts of breaches, we laughed about this at the beginning, like when we started the podcast, right? With Jerry was our first guest about how breaches were accelerating and that, you know, if a breach happens, does anybody actually care anymore? Right. You just look at the number of breaches that we're hearing about, like on the software supply chain side nowadays, right? Like that seems to be the new avenue, watering hole attacks, right? Like if an attacker can add malware to a place that they have thousands of people downloading software from, then guess what? You know, they only have to breach one credential in order to infect thousands of people. That's where they're going to target, right? It's very similar to cloud-based attacks or other things in the past. But the number of breaches that are occurring in that space, I feel like we're reaching a level of breach fatigue that we've never had before. So just even following Jen and Paul at opensourcemalware.com, right? Like the number of breaches that they have to respond to or are writing up on like a weekly basis is turning into something rather insane or ridiculous. And then on top of that, the number of CVEs that are being released, right? Like on the white hat side of the house as well. I don't know how you keep up in an organization anymore, right? I have a hard time keeping up and I'm like continually connected.
Yeah, I know. It's well, and you know, I think this kind of, you know, we got this other change that, you know, speaking of GitHub and NPM and compromised packages came across, which we'll chat about here in a second. But the whole idea is that this is a way to stem the bleeding, essentially. Like there are so many, I mean, you know, I know everybody's basically trying to figure out a way to I would assume anyways, I know I am, figure out a way to proactively protect customers, like, because this stuff just keeps happening and it's going to happen, you know, while they're asleep, while they're away, when it's a weekend, you know what I mean? And you have to kind of like the new kind of world that we're moving into is like more and more and more needs to sort of be autonomous and auto, you know, auto patched, auto protected, auto defended. That's just kind of becoming table stakes for the new world that we're living in, where this stuff just, you know, happens so frequently. And you could guess why, or you could try to speculate, but it's happening regardless. So I like that this is, and to that end, this article is about, you know, trying to stem the bleed. Last week, if this is the 26th, then what would that be? The Friday? Would it have been Friday? 23rd, 24th, 25th? Yeah, Friday. Yeah. So last Friday, NPM, who is owned by GitHub, who is owned by Microsoft, that's my own personal. That makes me laugh and only me. But anyways, they put out something that is pretty neat. So the idea with staging is that in this scenario that we just talked about, or say like a GitHub user's credentials are stolen and compromised. And so then somebody pushes a malicious workflow file because they don't have branch protection. And now it runs whatever code they just pushed up there, right? Well, if that code's malicious and it's inside of an NPM package, when that CI/CD action runs, it's going to publish that malicious code immediately. With this, instead of that kind of flow happening, what will happen is that would get automatically pushed into a staging pipeline, which is visible. Everybody can see what's in the staging pipeline. At that point, the actual maintainer has to then use multi-factor authentication, they say 2FA. I'd love for that to say MFA, but anyways, human maintainer, and you can see this. I'll zoom in on it. Well, too much zoom there. Sorry. Sorry. There we maybe go. I thought I had it. Yeah. Stage publishing reinforces proof of presence on every publish, including those that originate from non-interactive CI/CD workflows. That's exactly what we're talking about, right? We just don't want something like Actions to automatically package it up, push it, and then people just start downloading it. Instead, we want them to push it up, put it in the pipeline, and then a human being with a separate, different set of credentials from their GitHub account go in that is protected by 2FA, and then say, yes, I am the one to have then pushed this package and blessed it and say it's okay for release, which, you know, I don't know. What do you think, Seth? Do you think that's enough? Do you think that's going to help? Do you think that's, I mean, where do you think there's some?
I do think it will. I do think it will help. I fall back to the question on 2FA, right? Like what the 2FA actually looks like there, because it isn't MFA. At least it's something, right? Like it is a stopgap for, there is a, you know, compromised credentials. Somebody's been able to push. Somebody has to at least approve. A human has to at least approve it. Now that doesn't mean that there's not going to be attacks against the humans in those cases, especially for the high value targets in these watering hole attacks. But involving a person or having to bother a person also exposes those attacks quicker, right? If I'm a developer that has a popular NPM package and all of a sudden I'm getting texts or whatever it is with codes in them, I know something's happened, right? Like the second that, you know, stages are going that I didn't necessarily know about, that's one thing. Now, it doesn't mean that you couldn't actually look at how the flow normally happens when those stage commits go out. Smart attacker is probably going to take a look at normal patterns and try to sneak something in during the normal, you know, stage release or whatever it is. So it still is going to require some vigilance, but it should reduce the amount of, or like the blast radius that is currently happening in the software supply chain attacks, at least for NPM. That being said, I haven't looked at any of the other package repositories for staged commits. Is this something else, or whatever they're calling it, right? Like, is this something that like PyPI is already doing that NPM is just catching up on, or I don't know that. Right?
No,
like,
that'd
be a question for Paul and Jen and the people that are in the space on a daily basis, like where those protections actually are. But it will be interesting to see whether or not the number of breaches actually decreases with this in place, at least on the NPM side of the house.
I'm looking it up. I was curious if I could, no, PyPI does not have stage. And that was actually, okay, so that it was a comment I dropped, I forget, on somewhere on the internet. I dropped a comment regarding all this, basically like saying, why, like, it's so frustrating that none of the package managers like seem to, surely there should be a committee where there's standards for package managers so that like when new stuff such as Hugging Face comes out or some new skill, whatever, or whatever distribution system it is for whatever type of thing it is, I would consider that supply chain package management regardless. And they never standardize. It's the one true control. Yeah. Sorry, I just happened to get distracted by Bobby's. No, but it's really frustrating. It's like, can we please have like a freaking package manager committee or something with some standards that it's like, hey, are you thinking of distributing software that's going to run on the machine? Maybe you should look at, you know, the last freaking few decades of crap that we've been dealing with and, you know, avoid all those problems from the beginning and just. It's kind of like your same complaint about web frameworks. It's like every time a new web framework comes out, they've gotten some sort of like amnesia about all the problems that all the other ones face. And they're like, I think this time I'm going to do it again, differently, worse, you know? And it just feels like we never learn, and it's so defeating. So anyways, I don't know. This is me shouting into the wind, but,
It's really interesting because we have these core infrastructure components that live on the internet, especially for developing software like NPM. I don't necessarily want to just pick on NPM because the package managers across the board have always suffered from this, but we always back ourselves into this corner between security and usability and speed of deployment for developers, right? Like, a lot of these services get picked up initially in this infrastructure because of how usable it is and how quickly you can get from, hey, I have an idea, to actually a released full product. We saw the same thing with OpenClaw, right? People started using OpenClaw because they realized they could use agents and they could actually deploy things very quickly and build an application overnight using agents, right? It was this amazing thing, and they could have OpenClaw go out and do all this stuff for them without considering the impacts of security on that. And we saw problems because of that, right? Like the lack of direction, the lack of security, the lack of Crocs and socks when those are actually deployed. But we've seen the same thing over and over again, right? Like everything new or everything old is new again seems to be a running joke in technology during our careers, right? Like, you know, you saw web frameworks that made mistakes, and then they implemented a new web framework and it made the same mistakes as previously because they wanted to distribute that quickly. Part of the game is getting enough market share quickly so that your framework, your product becomes the one that lives, right? It's just the technology space in general. So OpenClaw got thousands of users, hundreds of thousands of users very quickly, and now got acquired by OpenAI. That was the goal, I take it, right? Like but they didn't have to consider security because it was all about speed of deployment. And that's what we're struggling with here as well. I like NPM and those other ones, it was so easy to get your package out there and be subsumed by other or consumed by other projects, that's what everyone defaulted to. Now, I know there's other package managers that probably took security more seriously during the design phase, but because they did introduce those gates, everyone went to NPM because that's what everyone was using and was really easy to actually get packages released.
Yeah, and I want to address because to your point about like the easeability, like meaning, so yeah, trying to build something that's secure enough, moves fast enough, keeps up with, you know, getting traction for users. Like users don't like logging into things. We all know that. It's like why Nextdoor had such a problem as an app for a long time until they switched out, I think, to like Magic Links or something like that. So you could just get logged back in. And that's wrong. Facebook didn't make you log back in, right? Forever, really, and in earlier days before there were like stronger controls, and there's just like there's a reason for that, right? So I'll say I understand that. I also understand, I think maybe where Bobby's coming from, where he says I like the idea, but then we run into App Store style problems of approvals, like the App Store. And yes, the App Store is really heavy-handed, but that's not actually what I'm that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if you're going to build a new package manager, you know that like you should have 2FA or MFA, I would say MFA, required for somebody who's going to publish a package, right? Simple things like, MFA, password complexity, controls around typo squatting. Like we all know all the different ways that these packages essentially get kind of owned. There are very public stories to look at, and there's very public responses to, well, here was the issue, and then here's how we solved it. We see it over and over and over again, like the same types of things and the same types of controls spread out depending on which package manager had been breached, right? My whole point is not necessarily let's make a heavy-handed process. I'm just saying that if we already know all the shit that keeps hitting supply chain package distributors, we know the fixes they keep employing, why is there not a single standard that people can point to and say like, okay, here's my checklist of things. If I'm going to if I'm going to put software that's going to run on your machine or a machine, then I should probably do these minimum responsible list of things. And so that's where I'm coming from. Not necessarily like, I think you should just have like some heavy handed process on the back end.
I would agree there should be a standard, but you know, this is the traditional like human problem that we've had for years, right? Like how many times have you seen, how long did it take for us to convince developers not to write custom crypto routines for storing passwords? Right. Think early on in our career.
And I don't know if that's ever been solved fully.
Yeah. I know. Exactly. Right. Like it's like we have these like bodies that create these standards that we have to make it so incredibly easy to use that the developers will default to that. And if anything, what we're seeing nowadays with this surge in AI developed code, we're seeing implementations that are non-standard just to get the job done as quickly as possible. Right? So the traditional development problem that we've always had with juniors is they're going to go reinvent the wheel. And now we have AI reinventing the wheel across like custom code bases because, again, everyone thinks that they're a special flower, right? Like whatever it is that they're designing is different and, oh, my framework's going to be better because, you know, it uses caching or whatever it is. So, hey, guess what? We're going to cache all those passwords, however, you know, so that we can speed things up, or we're going to come up with a new standard. To Larry's point, right? Like, you know, they always come up with a new standard. And so I, you know, while we do understand those problems, Ken, yes, to your point, I don't see this going away with the amount of code that's being generated and the different approaches that are being thrown out into the world because of the use of Claude Code and Codex and AI agents as we're actually building these things. If anything, the next 6 months, year, it's probably going to get worse because we're reinventing the wheel over and over and over again. Oh, cool. OpenSSF actually has a principles for package repository security. Awesome.
Yeah, I was like, surely there has to be something out there. So this is, yeah, it does seem like there's something.
Oh, February 2024. Yeah.
There you go. Oh man.
Yeah.
Should probably reach out to them and talk to them, maybe even have them come on the podcast. Because this is like such a frustrating, my God, this is such a frustrating thing to watch over and over and over. It's like, this is just annoying. Like it shouldn't, you shouldn't have these. Okay. So yeah, this is what I'm talking about. Like, I love this. There's just some, you know, some basic controls. Oh, this is awesome. Hey, good work, Jack Cable and Zach Steinler. Hope I said that right.
And I mean, honestly, you look at this, this is not overly complex either, right? Like it's not, I mean, the levels, you know, the implementation might be complex, but the basic controls that we're looking there for there, the basic principles aren't that crazy, right? Granted, this is version 0.2. And if anything, you know, we learned that standards like go off the rails pretty quickly, but this is a good start. Yeah.
Drop that in. Well, I was going to say, yeah, if you want to, I'm going to put this in general. So if you're in our Slack, if you're not in our Slack, Seth said at the beginning of this episode, you probably want to join our Slack. I did. So you can email info@absoluteabsec.com. Again, info@absoluteabsec.com if you want to get an invitation. I've been pretty good, I feel like, of getting to people, getting to people's requests. So usually within a day, you'll get an invite. And you can join. So in the general channel, I'm putting the repo right now where you can go and you can add your thoughts on the standard for the upcoming 2.0 standard, it sounds like. So.
Yes. Yeah. Sweet. All right. We've got a whole bunch of articles here, Ken. What else do you want to actually talk through today?
Oh, there's another one. Yeah. Here, I got another one for you. So there, okay. I just thought this was interesting, only this will be very quick, I think. So this is Go CMS. There's kind of two things that have been going on in terms of like frameworks. So Ghost CMS, and then Laravel had some issues with its, again, talking about compromised packages and all that fun stuff. But anyways, I was just curious. I was like, well, you know, there's this large scale SQL injection flaw. Like, what was the actual SQL injection flaw like? So I looked up the CVE and then I found a link to the fix. And when I looked at it, I was like, it just made me laugh because I was like, oh, hold on.
Now I need to see it.
That's great. it doesn't take long. Anyways, it just made me laugh and I figured I'd show it. So if you're not watching and you're listening, it's like basically the most obvious interpolated SQL. And then they replaced it with a parameterized query. That's the fix. But what's funny is I wanted to see, I was like, wait, was this, I was just curious if this was like another AI editor introducing SQL injection, because a lot of people don't know, but they're actually pretty, it's weird, but they should be.
They're so pretty bad at it. Yeah.
Pretty bad at like introducing it. Yeah. Cause but that's not the point. I was curious just to see if like maybe an AI editor introduces. This was back in 2020 though. So it definitely was not an AI editor. It definitely was a human being that pushed this SQL injection. But in case you're curious, that's what all the hoopla is about. This one line right here caused quite a stir. So
it is Ghost, right? Ghost CMS. How was it identified? Did you figure that out? Was it somebody using some sort of AI or?
Campaign was discovered by XLab researchers at Chinese cybersecurity company. I don't know how to pronounce that, but I will, look that up. Hold on. Let me close this out so people don't watch me type around.
I almost feel like it'd be useful data from an attribution perspective. Even when people are using AI assistants and workflows and slash code review or whatever else on how this is actually identified, or was it part of that like latest Mythos craze or whatever it is, like release that, like how they're actually identifying those things. I don't know.
It doesn't seem like somebody who was a white hat found the flaw. It sounds like somebody was
actually exploiting it.
Yeah, and they traced it back to that. Fix SQL. I'm looking for the found SQL. Oh, sorry. Not the one I want. I was hoping maybe like it would point back to a specific, you know what I could do is I could actually go and look at issues and pull requests and try to find if somebody actually disclosed that here.
Well, yeah, because the blog from XLab said they detected a poisoning incident targeting a critical customer's Ghost CMS. So it feels like they only identified it because they were monitoring a client, or they were called in to actually do forensics for a client. And that's where it was identified.
Damn. Wait, where did you see that? Here, let me stop sharing. Where did you see that at?
So I translated their the blog post from XLab. Here, I'll share it really quick. I'm going to drop the link in there. Of course, it's all in Chinese or whatever, but, and then I translated it.
Okay.
Yeah. So they detected a poisoning incident and then attackers exploited a high-risk SQL injection. So that's what I was getting at, right? Like they detected the poisoning incident. So they actually saw the traffic or some sort of SQL
injection. Oh, they saw somebody doing it. I see. Okay.
So it was during active exploitation. And then they did the reverse back to, oh, look, this is the code. It's all over, and did further research into how many institutions and public sites are affected by this. So that was more of traditional. It wasn't actually identified by an AI agent locally that was running against code review, doing code reviews or anything like that. I don't know. I was saying this, that's more of a traditional, what we've seen in the past.
Next time we have our students choose an open source app from the course, I'm going to be recommending this one.
Ghost Lab CMS. You imagine that they've probably dug through a little bit more of that at this point.
Why is there this Seth guy trying to put Chinese malware in the general channel? So for those that can't see, he loaded a link in Slack and it all came out in Chinese. In Mandarin. I was going to say Mandarin, but I actually don't know if what Mandarin.
Oh, it might not be. It might be Cantonese or something else. I'm
just not educated assumption. Enough to know.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, good old fashioned regular SQL injection. I love to see this vanilla one line SQL injection that's catastrophic. In some way, somehow, that's become refreshing. And like interesting to me.
next thing we're going to do is step to, in 2002 and start talking about cross-site scripting again, right? Is that what you want to do?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe I'm back to liking cross-site scripting. Maybe that's the full arc. It's just, old stuff's boring. I need new stuff. Oh, there's too much new stuff. Okay, crap. I need nostalgia. Let's go back to the old stuff. That's just how...
I am there. Talking about user enumeration, so let's
just talk about logging and username enumeration. That's not very novel
change. I know, exactly.
Sweet. But I think it's been interesting to see some of these changes, just there's just this massive, I'm just thinking about this whole package management kerfuffle and team PCP and Lapsus and all the stuff going on. It's just sort of it's at least forcing a response and some focus on security hardening. So that's cool. That's good. I can't complain.
Yeah. Speaking of old school things, right, becoming new again, that other post just before we close things out, I know we're at, top of the hour. We haven't gone quite as long today, but AI-powered honeypots making a return, or honeypots in general making a return to news. Shout out to TLDRSec. I think this was one that Clint actually highlighted. But I've been thinking about this for a little while as I'm having Claude help me build out applications that are vulnerable for very specific reasons. All these AI agents are out there scanning the web nowadays for specific vulnerabilities. The more that you deal with the agents, the more you realize that they do have a tendency to focus on very, very certain categories of vulnerabilities unless instructed to do otherwise. And so building a honeypot that will actually take that attention from an agent and just cause it to spin doesn't sound like the worst idea in the world. And so we've got Talos Intelligence over here actually building out, and this actually came out, a couple of weeks ago, but we have them building out, you're showing it there. Yeah. AI-powered honeypots and, customized honeypots for specific agents. Given the focus that both the attackers are using agents nowadays, but also red teamers are using it as well. This feels like an easy way to distract and get in the way of those agents to prevent targeting other portions, right? Like if I can create a single page in my application that's basically a honeypot for that agent and get it stuck there, analyzing SQL injection over and over and, determining that there's this one critical vulnerability, we're increasing the noise that agent is generating, which means it's making it less trustworthy and probably won't go after other portions of the application. There's some interesting research that should be done here, dude, right? That I've been thinking about.
This is fascinating because I didn't think about this, but yeah, I mean, okay, so AI-driven systems prioritize speed over stealth. That actually makes sense. But then you talk about it being like a hall of mirrors, essentially, right? Confusing the AI agents. And it says they, I don't know if it's an inherent lack of awareness. I actually think it's just there's some part of a human brain that can do some things with that are hard for models to just do inherently. And this is where I think it gets really interesting is like, you could in theory just like make somebody spend insane amounts of money and turn the tables on them and actually end up making them spend a shitload of tokens to get nowhere on your system through this quote unquote hall of mirrors. And that, yes, my friend, makes me feel very good that I could waste somebody else's money and time as they try to attack me through one of these. That makes me so happy.
this is a real problem, right? Like attention, right? Like generative AI attention is easy. It's easy to distract, especially these long running agents. So why not create a system to do that and distract and burn those tokens as an attacker is coming after you, right? Like we should be able to identify that very quickly in the traffic, the dynamic traffic that's going back and forth. This sounds like a great area of defense that hasn't been explored or highlighted enough up to this point.
Dude, this is why I just don't see inference costs and frontier models being it, because when you think about steady state costs, especially, you know, that comes to fruition by primarily hosting your own open source models on your own hardware, right? That's how you get like a steady state. And I'm saying that because I was thinking about it. I'm like, damn, if I have to spend more cycles doing more work to detect like this quote unquote hall of mirrors, and you have to spend more and more tokens to set up these hall of mirrors, I know I always go back to the economics of it, but I really think that's probably an important thing to focus on is like cat and mouse means more tokens are going to be spent, more tokens are going to be spent, more tokens. There's only going to be more token usage. You can't really, to keep this from getting out of control, basically, I think like, obviously there'll be technical solutions as well, you know, not just spending more tokens. But I do think there is like a token cost, a hidden token cost to think about here, both on defense and offense as things improve on both sides. It's going to just cost more. That's all I'm saying.
It is. It is.
If you don't move to open source, do this stuff.
Is this not an AI capture? No, it is, right? Like, that's a good point, Bob. Yeah, I mean, just spinning something up that responds positively with vulnerable responses, right? Like, I mean, this goes back in the day, right? Like, you could spin up, what is the IDS? Snort. There was a system that you could spin up that would actually generate Snort, like, signatures, based on whatever it is that you wanted so that it would trigger an IDS, right? Like you could generate traffic to specifically trigger Snort to go off the rails and report that attacks were happening. And it was, you know, in that case, it was to hide like malicious traffic that was inbound with Snort as well, right? Like, you know, the IDS is in and of themselves because it was a pattern-based system. I'll have to look up what that is. But this feels very similar to that, right? Like, why not do something similar against the attacks that are happening nowadays, the modern attacks that are there? And I don't know about actually using an LLM to generate these, because again, token cost, but there should be a way to create like vulnerable instances in a manner that will distract. Wait, what is this saying? What is it that you're looking at here?
Sorry, it made me laugh. Right? It's ChatGPT. So what they're doing is every time somebody enters a command in, they're like, yeah, pretend like you're Linux and just pretend you're running these commands and doing stuff and send something back. Oh, that's beautiful, man. That's fucking hilarious to me. Oh, that's really funny. Sorry, that I don't mean to get off track. You had a really good point there. But yeah, it's super funny.
No, this is great, right? Like you're having LLMs respond to LLMs and Yeah. If there was a fixed cost on your side and a variable cost on theirs, this is amazing, right? Like, yeah.
If Linux system that you're impersonating belongs to a junior software engineer learning Python, the file system structure and the contents of any file should reflect that expected of a Python learner. Oh, that's genius. I love that. And then look, it does netcat. It's like, yeah, here's your file system. Now, what I will say with that is that anyways, whatever. I could go down a rabbit hole with this. I could, because, you know, like, then will it be the same scripts that come up? And there's ways to make sure that the same directory listing comes up and blah, 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 blah. But that's so funny. That's pretty awesome. shows you, yeah. This is amazing.
My best guess. It's a smart fridge. No, it's an IoT simulator.
Yeah. My best guess, yeah. Smart fridge or coffee machine, IoT simulator, deliver minimal embedded firmware. Yeah, automation does not simply amplify attackers, but also constrains and exposes them. And that's very true, especially if they're using an AI-backed system, yeah.
Yeah, and this isn't actually an area in like AppSec specifically, in application security, that we haven't explored that much in general over the last 20 years is the use of honeypots, right? Like that's always been something that's been maintained kind of on the network security side of the house, right? Like, oh, we have these open ports. We have like TCP, like long running like instances where we open up, open up ports. We actually respond that every port is open, right? To kill the scanners, like that sort of thing. We haven't done that as much on the AppSec side of the house. So it'd be interesting to explore now that we're seeing more and more attacks higher up in that TCP or the, in the TCP IP stack, right? Like, where do we, or the IP stack, whatever it is, right? Like,
OSI.
OSI, there we go. That's what I was thinking of. In the OSI model. Wow, man, my brain today. But in the OSI model, now that we're seeing those attacks higher up, it'd be interesting to explore what those honeypots actually look like and their effectiveness against things like, oh, I don't know, Expo, right? Like, as it comes in and it decides that it's trying to identify all these things, could you not just respond positively across the board and skew those results so horribly that, again, the systems become untrusted? Not that I need another research project, but sounds like a fun one if somebody wants to jump in on it. All right, we've been going for about an hour, Ken. Yeah, appreciate the discussion today. Appreciate everybody actually jumping in and commenting. As always, join us in Slack, info@absoluteappsec.com if you need an invite. And yeah, anything else you want to add for today?
For those in the States, hope you had a good Memorial Day. How about that? Thanks there for listening.
Go. Yep. Go touch some grass. It's good for you.
It is. It is. Yeah. It is.
All right, everybody. We'll see y'all online. Appreciate you.